Okay, a big warm welcome from the Literature Committee to our symposium today, Translating Traditional Tales and Folklore. Just before we begin the symposium, we wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, the Boon Wurrung and the Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. So just to, for those of you who don't know a lot about ALITRA, just giving you a quick rundown about our organisation. ALITRA is a national organisation that promotes an interest in all aspects of literary translation. We sponsor public lectures and events on literary translation, such as today, and hold periodic conferences with university bodies interested in the theory and practice of literary translation. We also distribute news of events, conferences, and other initiatives which are relevant to literary translators. In addition, ALITRA publishes an online journal, the ALITRA Review, carrying peer-reviewed articles and translations. This is available for free once a year. If you have an interest in literary translation, especially world literature in translation, then please do consider joining our organisation. You'll find a membership form on your seat, or you can come and have a chat with one of us. And ALITRA is on Twitter and Facebook. So to keep up with our latest news and to hear more about literary translation from an Australian perspective, please follow us and tag us in a tweet if you'd like us to pass things on for you. Also, just a bit of housekeeping before we get going. So in case of an emergency, please exit by the front stairs, so near the lift. Obviously, don't use the lift if it was an emergency. And assemble at the Swanston Street end of Ferry Street. Toilets are further down the corridor, that way, and there's also a kitchen at the far end of the corridor if you need. Okay. Now, just a special note, we do have a colleague here today who has a severe coffee allergy. So for this reason, please do not bring coffee into the room. Cool drinks will be provided at 3:15, and we ask that you be back to your seats promptly at 3:45. What will happen is we'll have video conferencing for our third speaker, who's actually had to go to Cairo this week. Also, we have books on sale on a special price today, cash sales, and they're available at the interval and briefly at the end of the day. And to lead into the symposium now, so Symposium Translating Traditional Tales and Folklore, this actually relates to the UNESCO 2019 Year of Indigenous Languages. So languages and their translations play a crucial role in the daily lives of people, not only as a tool for communication, education, social integration and development, but also as a repository for each person's unique identity, cultural history, tradition and memory. Despite their immense value, languages around the world continue to disappear at an alarming rate. In order to make people benefit from the language they speak, as well as make others appreciate the important contribution these languages make to the world's rich cultural diversity, it is necessary to raise the awareness of these languages. The UNESCO 2019 Year of Indigenous Languages was designated to promote and to protect Indigenous languages and to encourage harmonious and cooperative relations between states and Indigenous people. Today, we are delighted to welcome Harley Lee Donnelly, Community Linguist and Project Officer at the Victorian Aboriginal Corporation for Languages, or VACL, and a member of the Dja Wurrung Clan. And we have Ruth Singer, a linguist based at the University of Melbourne's Research Unit for Indigenous Language. She researches multiple languages. She researches multiple language practices in Arnhem Land in partnership with Wurrawuri community, which is from Northwest Arnhem Land. And I believe you should all have a copy of their biographies on your seats as well. So Ruth and Harley will talk about their work at translating and preserving languages with outback communities. And Harley will also describe the work at VACL. At the end of their conversation, you'll be happy to answer your questions about protocols for adapting and translating Indigenous books for dissemination throughout the world, and of course, any other questions you might have. And this is the format we'll follow for today. We'll have hear from our speakers, and then we'll have about 15 minutes question time, then move on to our next speaker. So that's enough from me for now, I think. Please welcome our speakers.
Thanks very much for having us here today. I'm sure this is a bit of a different topic to what you usually hear about. I'll just briefly talk about the work I do with Wadawi community in Western Arnhem Land, and then Harley's going to talk more about his work with Victorian languages and translation. Oh, yeah, that's true. I just changed this. Okay, thank you. That would be great. I've been working with Wadawi community since 2002. It's a small community, and it's on the map here. I don't know if that's a bit too small to see, but it's a few hundred kilometres west of Darwin, it's about an hour on a small plane from Darwin. And there's about 400 people living there. And this is just a picture of some people I work with. Janet Maibindo, who's a young language worker, and her grandmother, Rachel Mainborough, who they often work in partnership together. And then Paul Naragoj in the wheelchair there, who's one of the last speakers of the Gunbalang language. Mostly I work with the Maung language, but I also support work on the Gunbalang language, there is also another linguist who works on Gunbalang. There's a few other linguists who work on Gunbalang with people, but sometimes when I'm there, I help a bit. And this was an interesting recording session when there was a lot of translation going on. So basically, Paul was telling stories in such a way that he would tell one line, and then Rachel, who understands Gunbalang well, would say it in Maung, and with the idea being that young people who still speak Maung a lot, or who understand it, like Janet here, will be able to understand the stories in the future, even when there's not so many people around who understand Gunbalang anymore. So I've worked closely with people translating stories and songs from Maung, mainly. And so the way we usually do it at the moment is if we record a story, Janet will then work on the transcription and the translation, and then after she's done it, then we'll go through it together, and sometimes with an elder, like a grandmother, discuss some of the meanings and how we could, work them in a way that's sort of truer to each language. And so it's a very collaborative process, and it takes a long time and has various steps. And because I'm usually in Melbourne, then it also involves, you know, Janet doing work, then I come up, and then we get together and that kind of thing. Usually we're working from audio recordings of stories from the start, but I guess ultimately the translation process is similar. And sometimes we do work with material in written form, because there was a lot of literature produced when there was a bilingual school operating in the community in Maung and English. So people in the community produced 350 books. So this is just a picture of one of them. This one is a non-fiction book about crabs, written by Rosemary Gurunama, who has also been a great mentor there, and we've done a lot of work together. There's also traditional stories in the form of these books for kids, and different things. And this book I recently worked on with three high school students from Wadawi who were living in Melbourne and attending high school in Melbourne. And it was a really interesting process because even though these books were written for kids, it can sometimes be very difficult for us to understand what the writer intended, which I think is partly because it's a very new language, it's a written language. Maung has only been written for a few decades. And so sometimes the way people write is maybe very similar to how they might talk, and you know, when you're talking, you can negotiate the meaning if people don't understand it. But when they're written and we go back to them decades later with these young people, we're sometimes like, well, what did the old people mean? So the first story about the mud crab, which is one of the most important crabs up there, partly because it's delicious, apparently. I'm vegetarian. the story about the mud crab seemed to involve a shepherd and some sheep. And I think Rosemary was talking about a game that the kids played that somehow involved shepherd and sheep and the crab, but we haven't had a chance to talk to her about it yet, and we couldn't work it out. Most of the other stories about the other crabs, we did feel like we got a bit further with, but not always 100% confident in our translations. And so what we do with these books to sort of bring them back to life for the next generation is record a video where the young people read it out in Hmong, and then they read their translation in English. And so, and then you see the different pages of the book in the video to try and bring it back to life for young people, a lot of whom don't have a chance to learn to read Hmong anymore, unfortunately. So this way they can still access that knowledge in the books. Elaine suggested also that we talk a bit about the process of working with Indigenous communities on translation and protocols. And I guess Harley's talked about his experience of working with communities in Victoria. And I guess one of the things we were talking about before the talk is that it's not that different for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, because either way you still have to build a relationship with the community and go through the proper, systems of authority in that community. But Terry Younger, an Indigenous lawyer, has written this excellent book, Indigenous Cultural Protocols and the Arts, which actually I wasn't aware of before, because I don't really work in the arts, but it really encapsulates a lot of the important ideas. It has some case studies about people who are not doing translations, but they're writing books, children's books, about with an Indigenous theme or about Indigenous community, and they talk about how they went about that. And there is this other booklet. They're both available on the Australia Council website. You just download them for free. This other one about producing Indigenous Australian writing, which is also relevant, although a little bit older, I think. And so this booklet outlines these principles, which I think the first one is respect. And I think respect is obviously a very difficult concept, but I feel like respect is something that you start with a certain, approach, which is hopefully respectful, but then you actually have to learn how to respect people through getting to know a community and working with them, and what is respectful, I guess, in that community. And also Indigenous control. So I guess as an artist or an academic, recognising Indigenous control of Indigenous stories and things that concern their community. And so maybe I'll just leave it to you to read through the other ones, but it sort of elaborates on those points. And I guess just some stuff coming from, I guess, the ways I've learned to respect Indigenous knowledge through working with Warrawee community, I guess, is I think that a big leap for me was to understand how many things are owned as cultural property. So the first one for linguists is language, is that language is actually owned. And so for an English speaker, it's hard to imagine that, because our language is everybody's. In a sense, and I guess we almost enjoy that, and it brings a lot of privileges with it, but Indigenous languages, like land, is owned, and actually is owned as part of that ownership of land, and so if somebody owns their language, then you have to think about that, and that has a lot of different consequences in terms of how you might work with them in things to do with language. And so also these songs, stories and dances, like Harley was presenting, are also owned by a specific group, such as a clan or a language group. And so these things are owned, but they're also owned in common. So that makes the whole idea of respecting Indigenous ownership and, something that relies on, I guess, a long-term commitment to getting to our community and working with them, because you can't just go up to one Indigenous person and say, hey, all right, if I do this or whatever with your language or translate this, but actually you have to take into account the whole community and the systems of authority that are operating there. You have to learn about what organisations, which individuals have the authority to make decisions about different things in that community. And you have to anticipate spending a lot of time in consultation and collaboration, and ideally, I guess, anticipate paying people who work with you, because you're taking up their time and they're often very busy people, they have a lot of other responsibilities. And I guess when you're not paying people, just very much show appreciation for the help you get along the way. So that's where I wanted to end. Did you want to say anything else?
No.
That stuff? Okay, well, I think we're opening up to questions.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much. You do have biographies, so I won't say too much because we have to keep to time, as we will be linking up with our third speaker, who, when we booked him, was going to come along but is now in Cairo. So we're going to link through Zoom, so we need to keep to time if possible. Stephanie Smee is a translator from French into English. She has done a lot of work. She started off with the very famous French children's stories by the Comtesse de Ségur, which were a great success. Then she did No Place to Lay One's Head by Françoise Frenkel, which I could say a lot about that too, but look it up. It's well worth reading and knowing about. And her latest one, I'm going to skip on a bit here. Well, no, I won't. She and her mother have done some Swedish children's books. She'll probably tell you about that. And her latest one is The Godmother, a crime novel, which is a bit of a sensation in France. It's done really, really well. And it's a page-turner, really. So Stephanie's going to tell us a little bit about some of her experiences in translation. Thanks.
I'm going to have, I think, an interlocutor here with the lovely Caroline here, and we're going to have a bit of a conversation. I'm quite good at shouting, my children tell me. So is it better to perhaps try and do without the microphone, or would you prefer that I persist with it? How would you, speaking to the back there, can you hear me? Microphone?
Oh, okay. There we go.
And can you just have it a bit lower?
Yeah, there we go.
Is that's okay? Fantastic. Fantastic. So I think how we're going to go ahead is this. Because there's two of us, we might just perch, if that's okay. I'm going to introduce myself just a little bit more about and tell you a little bit about my background. And then I'm going to talk to you about some of the sort of guiding principles, I guess, by which I operate in my literary translating work. And Caroline has some questions as well, and we'll see if we can have a bit of a conversation and draw out some of the more interesting issues that that we deal with in our translating of children's literature. I'm also going to just hand over very briefly before I start to Caroline, who's going to just say a little bit about her work on her PhD as well, just so you can understand where she's coming from.
Thank you, Stephanie. So my name is Caroline. I'm a freelance translator, so I work from English into French, and Stephanie works from French into English. And I'm just about to submit my PhD in translation studies, and I work in children's lit. So that's why we're having this conversation together today, I guess.
Yeah. Fantastic. So Elaine introduced me briefly. I guess my linguistic background is this. My parents are both fairly extraordinary linguists, and I guess it's something has come down in the water to me. My mother is Swedish, and she speaks about five languages. And my father, he's Anglo-Australian, but he also speaks probably around five languages as well, although two of them are dead, so he's not speaking them so much. But that's very good from a grammatical point of view, because Latin and ancient Greek are good for pedants, and as we all know, most translators need a touch of pedantry in them, I think, to proceed. I came to translating probably as a second career. I had a degree in languages, and I did my honours in French, but I was also doing a law degree, and I couldn't quite decide if I wanted to be a lawyer or not, and so my honours degree straddled both law and French, and I ended up doing a thesis in French marital rape law, which in hindsight it would have been a much nicer year probably if I'd spent it reading poetry. But anyway, I ended up working as a solicitor for a few years, and then I ended up going back to my love of languages and working as a first as a legal translator, which is very, very good training. It was an agency that specialised in sort of high-end legal documents, and who wanted only translators who had been lawyers. So they understood what the nature of that document, because I guess we think even though English is my mother tongue, there's another layer of register and expertise, I guess, once you have worked in a law firm to know what those documents are meant to sound like. So, and in the end, I think it was my brother, who was much braver than I was and abandoned his law degree much sooner than I did, said, why don't you start trying to do some of your literary translation, which is actually what you really love. I thought I might launch in with the most extraordinary description, really, of literary translation, which I have just come across, excuse me here, because I think it really gives an example of the nature of the task for literary translators. Ah, thank you. It's a quote from an interview with Michael Henry Heim, who was fluent himself in about 7 different languages, and he was responsible for many other translations for his translation of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which I think everybody in second year university sort of read at some point. And he was asked how he dared to translate from so many different languages. And it was in this context. He said the translator, having a solid grasp of a foreign language, its grammar and syntax, its sound possibilities, regionalisms, slang and idioms, all from the period in which one's source text was written, also a thorough understanding of its genre, its historical forms and variations, the poetics of the period in question, not to mention the author's range and experience, and then knowing at least as much or more about the linguistic and literary traditions of the receiving culture, its poetics and genres and sound possibilities, and so on. And not just knowing about them, but being able to manipulate them, which means creating literature within the receiving culture's conventions, handling pace or the sense of any ending, writing snappy dialogue, purple or minimalist prose, differentiated voices, and finding or creating metaphors, sayings, and turns of phrase appropriate to language users of different ages and cultures. And all of this, he says, is accompanied by a constant and nagging but healthy doubt, which I just thought was such a beautiful description of the actual task of literary translation. So, to children's literature. I started, my first published translations were the stories, or a number of stories by the Comtesse de Ségur, who has sold tens of millions of copies of her work. She's never been out of print in France, and basically, if you're French, I think you know the Comtesse. That presented a particular sort of mantle of responsibility, I guess. Similarly to the Swedish books I've translated with my... So the Comtesse, just for clarification, was writing in the 1850s to 60s predominantly, and she started work as a grandmother. She was translating to begin with, and she was writing them for her grandchildren. The other children's stories that I have translated primarily with my mother from Swedish, by a Swedish author called Gösta Knutsson, who is famous for his Pelle Svanslös stories, which are we have translated as Pelle No Tail, who is a little cat who has his tail bitten off by rat, which is not so nice for a cat. But similarly, if you're Swedish and you've grown up with stories of Pelle. In fact, they predate Pippi Longstocking, and every year, just to give you a sense of the significance, I guess, for the cultural heritage of these books, every year the Stockholm Opera produced an opera based on these beautiful stories. The Swedes have named asteroids after the characters in these books. And there are street names and so on. So again, this was the first time they had been translated into English, and they presented some interesting issues as well. I don't know that I would bill myself as a specialist in children's translation, but my last book is about a sort of a literary crime work dealing with Moroccan drug dealers and the French criminal system, which is fabulous, presented its own challenges. But there are particular issues about, that I think translating children's works throw up.
Okay, maybe let's start with La Comtesse de Ségur. If you haven't read any of her books, it doesn't matter, but as Stephanie said, they were written in the 1850s, and they're lovely, but they're dated. They're very charming, but completely dated in terms of style, in terms of content. Mm. So how did you approach those, and did you try to modernize them at all?
Excuse me, Caroline, we can't hear.
Okay.
Check that mic before you go on.
Sure.
A little bit closer?
There we go. So the question Caroline was asking about was the fact that these books are written in the 19th century, and clearly habits and style have changed a lot in children's works since then. I think it gets down to one of the fundamental issues. There are two aspects, I think, which sort of float across translation, literary translation in general, as guiding principles, which I think we try to employ as we go along. One of them, I think, is listening to the music of the text, which we're always trying to find the voice of the author, and also remembering, of course, the audience. So if you're translating for if you're translating instruction manuals for IKEA, you're going to be having a different goal to if you're translating children's literature. One of the things that I felt was very helpful to me when I was translating the Comtesse's works was, and this sounds perhaps a little flippant, but I don't mean it at all to be so, was that my daughter was about the same age as the characters and the audience for whom the Comtesse was actually writing. And I had her voice in my head the whole time as I was translating. And I think we have discussed earlier, one of the issues is sort of testing your work as you go for the musicality of the text. And I think children are really your harshest critics, because you can tell very easily whether you're going to lose them or not. So I would translate a couple of chapters and then try it out on my daughter that night, and I could tell very easily whether she was going to be bored or not bored at all. The Comtesse had a very particular stylistic habit which I was very keen to maintain. And it's a layout issue almost, which you and I have discussed, Kochadin, that in every edition that has appeared of these books, and you'll see if you want to go and flip through a couple of them, is that they are set out as plays almost. So in the way we tend to think of often children's literature, we have, certainly in chapter books, there's always a he said, she said sort of aspect to the work. The Comtesse sets out her characters with a very declaratory name for the person who's speaking, which I think really helps young people as they're reading, because they never have to worry about following the dialogue. It's announced who is speaking, who is not. So I was quite keen to keep that tradition in the layout. As for modernising, it's a question I have been asked about the Comtesse. To start with, the overriding sort of comment is this, that I think children's dialogue, and much of it is children's dialogue, is the same as ever in a way. And I think she had a very good ear for children's interactions, and so it felt actually that the content of the dialogue did not feel too dated when it was being translated. There were aspects. So, for example, there are a couple of things. She was speaking about her nanny or her nurse, and you sort of have to make decisions as to whether you're going to. Which word is going to be most appropriate? Those of us familiar with a lot of older English stories, perhaps nurse would have been a more appropriate translation. But I felt that our readers now, when we're being published, nanny was the word that they would recognise more and know. Similarly, when Sophie, in the first book, she's a very naughty girl. She is. She's dreadful. And there were a lot of dead animals in that book, which is funny. And yet modern children still seem to appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that she got sent to, for example, the repentance room on one occasion. And I perhaps took a liberty in that sense and translated it as the time out room, because I just felt, again, perhaps it was a liberty in the sense that it didn't have quite the same religious overtones, mm-hmm. of what she was meant to be doing in that room, as we would assume what our children are doing when we send them to a timeout room or have them sit on the stair. But again, it was a concept that I think that, you know, children were able to deal with.
Did you have any sort of guidelines or maybe pressure from the publishers?
No, look, I think there were various... Look, I think there were some discussions along the way editorially about what was acceptable. I remember there was one aspect where there was a lot of whipping involved, and we decided perhaps beating was a bit better than whipping, and we had that sort of conversation. I think, if I might sort of digress a little bit about with that, is again that coming back to that that auditory nature of the musicality of the text and how we're dealing with it. I mean, just in terms of the way the words were set out, she was a great fan of the semicolon. You know, it was just endless semicolons, which we just wouldn't use in a children's, you know, text anymore. So that was something that got, you know, we dealt with that so along the way.
Would you say your approach varies if you're working for children or if you're working or translating for children, translating for adults?
Yeah. Look, I think it has to, and I think it comes down again to the sense of translating for your audience, and your approach is going to be different because you assume a different knowledge for what your audience is going to deal with.
That's the difficulty as grown-ups to imagine
what it is that they're going to deal with. One of the interesting difficulties, wasn't so much a difficulty, but an issue we dealt with the Swedish books was when there was one of the Pelle books. It's a series of about 13 books, and one of them we were due to translate was when Pelle, the little pussycat, went to America for the World Expo, and he an encounter or several encounters with African Americans, which was a very novel thing for a Swede back in that context. And again, it's historically. There was absolutely no suggestion that the author was being racist. In fact, there were sort of learning opportunities, I guess, that he within the story about that difference. And I think that went to your question about how children deal with a concept of other and something that is different to them. What is interesting to me was that the Swedish publishers said that they would not publish that book again, and the Australian publishers here also followed their lead and said that that one was not published. Yeah, which is an interesting, and I mean, again, that's an editorial decision that publishers know more about what is likely to sit on a school library shelf and what parents are likely to do with. As I said, it's interesting. There were reviews. I passed them to the publishers that showed that really there was no way that the author could be accused of anything that was untoward in that sense, and yet it was simply sort of not touchable. in that sense. It was interesting. Yeah.
That Swedish book you translated with
yeah.
your mother,
yes.
which I find interesting. Can you tell us about the process? How does it work?
Yeah. Well, so again, we ended up having that opportunity to really listen to the text again. So you have to imagine, my mother is absolutely mad as a cut snake, but rather superb. So we sat side by side, and I did the typing, and she would often read it out. And because it was the language, again, of my childhood and the Swedish that I was hearing, you know, in my head, we had this wonderful opportunity to collaborate, and I could tell, because we know each other so well, when I would suggest something, I could see on her face before she even opened her mouth whether she approved of the translation or not. And she would sort of raise an eyebrow or curl a lip, and I'd think, no, I haven't quite got that. We need to have another go. So we had this wonderful, it got back to that sort of auditory sense of translating, but also this fantastic ability to collaborate. She was a bit sniffy, I must say, about various things. So Knutsson was a radio announcer, and he loved wordplay. And that is one of the challenges, I think, that really comes up in children's literature, because a lot of the humour in children's books is based on wordplay and, you know, homophones and so on, which almost never are able to be translated easily. They're very, very rare that it falls out nicely for you in English. And he also loved a little ditty. He was quite fond of a little ditty. So he would have these little poems, again, which children love. And they were cute little poems that he would scatter through it. But that's when Mum and I actually often sort of clashed, because she would say, suggest a translation. And she'd say, well, that's not what it says. And so this comes to that issue of readability or loyalty to the text. And I was like, yeah, well, I know that it's not. Of course I know that it's not what the Swedish says. But if I say it as what the Swedish says, you know, we're going to be left with a very clunky rhyme or not rhyme that isn't going to work at all. I'm trying to sort of think of an example. I think Aurélie might have heard this one before, but I'll carry on anyway. And it's a bit of a tricky one to explain if you don't know Swedish, but we'll give it a go. So one of those homophone issues or the wordplay was to do with a little... is that the microphone making that horrible noise? Oh, I'm so sorry. There's a word in Swedish called julgransplundring, which is the party that you have when you strip the Christmas tree. So, you know, the Swedes are fond of a party or two. So why have one party when you can have two? And so the one of the little cats, who's not very bright, gets invited to a julgransplundring. And she thinks the plundra sounds very similar to flundra, which is flounder in Swedish. And so she thinks she's been invited to a party where there's going to be flounder. And if you're a cat, that's quite attractive. So it was this impossible situation of what we were going to do with that. And that it was one of those instances. I remember many of you will have seen and heard and perhaps know the wonderful Julie Rose, who's a translator from French, and she always said you needed to have a dog to be a good translator and go for a walk. And I think that's exactly what I did often with those sort of things, that you let your brain relax a little bit and work out what it is going to provide the answer. And we came up with a solution that was to do with Christmas crustaceans and decorations, and we ended up sort of making a rhyme, I think, that worked along those lines. They're not always perfect. Sometimes... you know, you think I can't, that's as close as I can get to making something that's palatable, you know, for the English speaker. But I guess that's part of it. You do your best. So I think certainly anybody, those of you who've translated poetry, I can't imagine the task of doing, you know, vast amounts of poetry, because seriously the rhyming and the meter and the rhythm is a challenge again all of its own. but I think when you are veering into the territory of poetic license, that is when readability needs to take priority over loyalty to the text.
You mentioned you mentioned the audience, you mentioned the text. I guess we could talk about the authors, because whether it's La Comtesse de Ségur or Jules Verne, I was wondering if you were doing any research before embarking on a new translation to try and get a feel for what the author wanted to convey. You can't talk to them.
No,
dead.
Of course, exactly. So that's an interesting question. So Jules Verne is a perfect example for that. So as I discovered to my horror, there is actually a website devoted entirely to the quality of Jules Verne's translations. And I have to say, I haven't gone to look to see whether my latest translation has made it onto onto that website. But it's an indication. I think after Agatha Christie, he's the second most translated author in the world. I think having leapt into this particular work, which is an unusual Verne work, it's a historical fiction rather than science fiction, and I think for that reason hasn't been well known to Anglophone audiences, because we know him as a science fiction, you know, children's author, and in fact the French don't categorise him in that way at all. And my understanding, I've heard from a number of people, French speakers, that in fact Michel Strogoff, this particular work is one of his favourites, and yet you'd be hard pushed to find an English-speaking person who's even heard of it. But I think having embarked on this translation, I had such admiration and sympathy, in a way, for the translators of his work previously without the interweb. I just simply don't know how they would have done it. I think he is criticised often, or his translators have been criticised for leaving out great chunks of lists. He was a great list maker, Jules Verne. He loved writing about, you know, when he was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you know, he would list, you know, at least 20 different sea creatures, and you know, he'd throw all this research into it. And I think there were many instances where I felt, you know, without access to the internet research that I have been able to have, I can understand why a translator, you know, 100 years ago, because most of them were translated contemporaneously and probably under great time pressure when they first came out, sort of would have thrown up their hands. I was lucky enough to be able to, in one instance I was looking in a glossary for a particular word describing, I think, a Tartar costume for a soldier in some very obscure part of the former Russian Empire. And I went into a French glossary, and the example they gave was from my book. And I was like, well, that's not helpful at all. I know it's used in that sentence. I need another example, thank you very much. But then you have this wonderful, it's almost like you feel like you've won the lottery when you can find a historical record, for example, of an explorer who was travelling through Russia at that time, and we have a record of it on the internet that uses the word, you know, that you have found, and gives you that extra context, and suddenly you think, oh yes, bingo, I know what they're talking about now. And similarly, even on a more basic level, I remember that it was always a description of how, you know, carriages were built, and in great detail the sort of joints that they used, and the wood that was used, and then if they were in, there was some Tartar camp, describing the sort of yurt-like structures that they had with horsehair plumes coming out of the top of the tent. And I can remember thinking, that just can't be right. I must have misunderstood something here. This is just impossible. And then I turned the page of the book that I was dealing with, and there was this beautiful illustration with, indeed, horse hair coming out of the top of the yurt. So you know, you win some, you lose some with that. But I think definitely any sort of translation, especially those historical ones, you are forced to do that research around. You know, it's the cultural references really that you're looking for, and I think that works. You know, for all of us working in the languages, that when we read an English language book, we sort of absorb those references without even recognizing that that's what they are, because they speak to the maps that we have in our brain already. And you know, I think if you were to sit down and read, you know, any number of the you know, authors which we're familiar with, if you were trying to explain, you know, going back into the other language, I only do it from, you know, French and other languages into English, but if you, that task, going back into the other direction, you really opens your mind to those very specific cultural references that need somehow to be worked in to the text. And you and I have had this discussion as well about the difficulty that literary translators have with not being able to provide footnotes. You know, if we're translating a legal document, then almost always we were, you know, able to clarify something and say, well, this is what the French says. We don't have that concept in the English legal system. This is the closest we can get. Here's your equivalent. Well, it doesn't really cut it in a translation, and certainly not one for children's literature. No.
Do you include glossaries?
So with the Comtesse books, I actually did. Yeah. I had that chat with the publishers and said, you know, I'd like to explain to the readers when it was written, by whom it was written, and also the notion of there was a wonderful description in a review of an Elena Ferrante book about drawing so you could see the bones of the Italian coming through the English translation, which I think is a lovely image.
Yeah.
And I think there are some of the decisions that I've had to make in the Comtesse books and also in the Swedish books about how much of that stuff you leave for children. How much are they able to cope with? Can you talk about a château? Can you talk about the Monsieur, Madame? Can you, you know, what can they understand? And so the glossary was useful from that point of view. And in the Swedish ones in particular, some of the Swedish words are seriously so funny that I just felt it's part of... I had no wish to sort of anglicise the books to the extent that children would feel that they were just reading a book that had been written in English. I think children in particular are open to the idea.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I think so too. But in academic circles, there's certainly a big debate about whether or not a child would be able to understand this and that. And
yeah. Yeah. No, look,
that's why so many words and sentences are left out, and I disagree with.
Yes. Well, I think you are constantly making those sort of decisions. So even just in a French, is it time? Yes. I always talk too much. Sorry. But just to finish very quickly, with an example that I think that all of you will understand. I mean, even just at the very basic level of saying whether you say papa or maman or dad, or you know, which the decision that you make about that. Is an indicator. So Anthea Bell, this is ridiculous, isn't it? I'm sorry, I can't.
The other one is the other one.
The Anthea Bell is just that extraordinary translator from French and German who did so much of the French literature. Asterix, she was responsible for Le Petit Nicolas, Little Nicholas. And what was interesting to me was, you know, when she was translating the Little Nicholas books, she chose to have little Nicolas calling his father dad, which felt very English, you know, and it's not the decision that perhaps I would have made. Then another translator of a children's book that Patrick Modiano wrote, Catherine Certitude, which is a beautiful,
book.
Just gorgeous. They chose the decision, papa, You know, so I think it feels like minutiae, these funny little decisions that we make along the way, but they get to
they have an impact.
They have an impact, they get to the rhythm of the book, and I think we shouldn't underestimate what children are able to understand, and if the fact that that opens a conversation with the person who's reading it to them, or then that they want to ask their teacher about it, then so much the better. And just as a final funny ending, one of the little words that we kept in the Swedish book was an insult. There was a very mean, nasty cat in there who was a bit of a bully, and he was great at throwing an insult, and he called the other cats dumboom and dumsnoot. And we decided to keep those words because they were so much more fun than dumb bum, really. I thought that, and it didn't hurt at all to have them left. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking now.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Cynthia and Caroline. So we have 10 minutes for questions before we go for a break.
Yeah.
You used the word English quite a number of times, and I don't know what it means.
Do you know, that's a very sensible point, and I take it in the spirit with which it's made. I have had not the children's books, but the adult books that I've translated have appeared in the UK and coming out in the US. And there are words that I have used in the Australian translation that those editors have picked a fight over. And an interesting one was fossicking in the Frankel book, when she was fossicking in the bookshop, which I just thought was beautiful. And the English editor, a man of letters, said he had never heard the word before. And what on earth was that? And when I did some research around it, sure enough, it's a word that stems from the Australian goldfields. And you know, so, and I said, fine, use rummaging, I don't mind. but that is exactly the point. And similarly, where it's coming out in the US now, they have chosen to change some of the references, say, for example, from kilometres into miles. I just simply don't understand why that's necessary myself. We understand miles perfectly well, and I don't quite understand, and particularly when the book is set in a European context. But similarly, you know, even when I was translating legal documents, we always specified which direction, whether you were translating it into US English or UK English, because, you know, they were the two. And I know there are many more, but yeah.
Can I add a little more? You did make some mention about questions of the sound of the language,
yes,
and meter and so on. So these are not the same in different dialects. So that may be a reason why a book translated in Australia might not go down well in other countries.
I think it's more to do with saleability. And you forget often that some of these decisions are taken out of the translator's hands and into the editor's hands. An example again from the Frankel is that when it appeared in the UK, they actually changed the title of the first chapter, which was In the Service of French Thought, which was beautiful because it really expressed the work that the Françoise Frankel was doing in Germany. She opened a French language bookstore in Berlin. And she felt very much that she was a cultural ambassador in Germany for French culture. And they changed that chapter heading to a bookstore in Berlin. And in fact, there was an article that criticised my translation. Well, I don't understand why Smee chose that. And it was like, Smee didn't. Smee fought very hard to keep the original title. But again, that's a publisher's, an editor's decision. I know the Spanish version of that book actually changed the title to A Bookstore in Berlin. And it was a huge bestseller. My understanding is that it's coming out in the US under that title as well. So there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah. There you go.
Can I just say one thing there?
I think as you become more and more famous, which you are, you will just do what Julie Rose said with Les Miserables, I think it was. The US publisher wanted to change it and said, oh, you know, a lot of these words are very Australian. And she said, yes, I'm an Australian translator. Leave them.
Yes. I know. I'm not Julie Rose yet, but maybe one day. Yes, indeed.
I am very curious about how your translation of La Comtesse de Ségur has been received today, because I am French,
yes.
and during my period of being a young French girl, I knew nearly by heart, you know, all the Comtesse of Ségur books, and I was able to identify with the characters.
Yeah.
And when I had my two girls here in Australia, I decided to read them to them, and I think they really enjoy them, especially the naughty one, like Sophie. And,
yeah.
And but you know, I have four grandchildren, and I have no idea. I don't think they would be interested at all in me reading to them, you know, this kind of book.
Yep.
Or story.
Yeah. Look, I think it's a very valid question. They have actually been incredibly popular here.
And I put, yeah, they have been, surprisingly so. Perhaps surprisingly, perhaps not. There's a reason that they have never been out of print in France, you know, and I think it's down to a couple of things, in my humble assessment. I think it is actually the quality of the interactions between the children. I think that hasn't changed. I think the way they, her ear for dialogue is so sparkly and so, I mean, I hope I've done it justice, but I think the way they interact is actually really attractive to children. I think they have a real sense of right or wrong, and I'm sure you would agree that the Comtesse had a very firm view of what was right and wrong. And I think children like that. I think they know when somebody is being awful and mean and rude and naughty, and they have a real sense of that. And I think, you know, there were times when I was translating, I mean, for example, when she cuts her fringe, I mean, my daughter sat at the piano stall and she has crazy curly hair, and there's another episode as well where Sophie stands out in the rain and wants to make her hair grow straight. My daughter had done exactly that and then had cut herself off some of the hair and gave it to me and said, can you put it back? I was like, no, I can't. But that's exactly the sort of stuff that she's describing. So yes, there are the old-fashioned aspects to it, and there are many of those. I mean, I did run into one woman in the park who said, oh my gosh, she said, there are really a few too many dead animals in there for my children. And you know, Sophie is very fond of cutting up goldfish and, you know, because she was going to make a nice salad composé, you know, or worrying about her turtle. There was another episode, I think, with the turtle who dies, you know, because she's taken out of water. But again, you know, these things, children, they're not being intentionally cruel in that way. And I think the very sort of moralistic universe that she's operating in still appeals to children. And they recognise that it's not current day. And yeah, there aren't a lot of fart jokes in there the way, you know, a lot of children's literature now, you know, focuses on that. But there's other stuff there that I think that still is quite universal. And the other, just at the final point, I think it is the way the books are set out that I think has really allowed children to engage with them very easily still. So a lot of reluctant readers find that they can follow that structure really easily and plough through the books. So maybe that's just my assessment.
And on that note, can we please thank our guests once again?
We'll now have a half an hour recess. Please help yourself to drinks. Oh, and Elaine has something to say before.
As we're going to link up with Cairo, unfortunately, Omid is in between Sydney and Cairo, and this week it happened to be Cairo. So we're going to link up with him exactly at 3:45. So if you could come back and be in your seats at 3:40, that would be really good, so the link goes ahead easily. And the other thing is that we do have some books on sale here, and they're at really good prices for the day only. And Stephanie didn't mention that the book of Mikhail Strogoff is a really, really beautiful publication. The Eagle Books publisher has made it an art book, really. So it's a lovely book if you feel like buying it for a gift for someone special. Thank you. Thank you all very much. Our next presenter is coming to us from Cairo. We were rather hoping he'd be here in person, but as he's not, welcome, Omid, this afternoon. Most of you will know, or perhaps you don't, the story of Omid's translation of No Friend But the Mountains. But I want to say a little bit about Omid himself. You have the biography in front on your seat, but Omid is a lecturer, a researcher, a community advocate, combining philosophy with interests in citizen media, rhetoric, religion, popular culture, transnationalism, displacement, and discrimination. It's a whole lot of things. And he's very, very highly educated and prepared for all those things, as you will see in the biography that you have with you. He himself has published numerous book chapters and journal articles. He's the author of Myth and Philosophy in Platonic Dialogues, and he's the translator, of course, of Behrouz Bouchani's book No Friend But the Mountains, Writing from Manus Prison, which is published by Picador. Now, welcome, Omid, and just in case there are people in the audience who don't know the whole story of No Friend But the Mountains, do you think you could tell us how it came to happen and how you became involved? Thank you.
First of all, thank you everyone for coming today. Thank you for having me. I was going to say good morning. It's morning here in Cairo, but I should say good afternoon to you over there in the afternoon. It's wonderful to be here. There's a lot of things I'm excited about in terms of this interaction today. I think in terms of the production of the book, it's so complicated, and there are so many different dimensions to it. Sometimes I'm confused about where to start, but I guess it's important to acknowledge the work of Munis Mansoubi here. Munis Mansoubi is living in Australia and Behrouz's first translator. So Behrouz would send passages ranging from one paragraph up to two pages to Munis, and she would be arranging these into different chapters based on Behrouz's instructions. So Behrouz started writing from 2013, from the very first period that he was in the detention centre since he was exiled to Manus Island. And so he would send them to Munis, and Munis would, based on Behrouz's advice, she would put them into different chapters. So soon after I came onto the project, they agreed to translate the whole book. And when I started, about 30% of the book had already been compiled into chapters and had been written. So when I received chapters from Munis, she emailed me PDFs. Every PDF, every chapter, was basically one long text message. So there were no paragraph breaks. There was no editing at that stage. So really, the translation process was also an editing process, and this involved a lot of consultation, a lot of collaboration, and a lot of sharing at the same time. So Behrouz and I would get involved in a lot of really deep conversations about different parts of the book, different parts of the chapters. He would, at the same time, while I was translating, add bits and pieces to the to each chapter. So he would send me sometimes one line, one word, sometimes a whole paragraph, and he told me, you know, insert this at different parts of the text. So it's like I mentioned, it's a very complicated, very convoluted process. And at the same time, we've been meeting with Munis Mansoubi and another Iranian researcher who was living in Australia before, Sajjad Kabgani. We would meet every week or every fortnight, and I would discuss with either of them. I would discuss the translations that I'd completed, and that would give me advice. We'd make changes. We'd have long discussions about the best way to present certain things. And so the second third and the final third of the book was actually written and translated at the same time. So the first third was before I actually agreed to the translation, and then Behrouz was writing and I was translating at the same time. And, you know, my translation was impacting his writing was impacting my translation, and then there were all these other people involved. So that's just a very, very short, very brief overview, but it's there's this whole a whole range of different dimensions and elements associated with it.
Is it a truly complex way of translating? Isn't it collaborative at the same time? And did you find...
And I forgot to mention, this is all done through WhatsApp, text and voice messaging, so that's another layer.
Yes, indeed. And I wanted to ask, now, Behrouz is Kurdish, is that right? He's
yes.
Kurdish. And you wrote somewhere, I can't remember where, that he uses a lot of Kurdish mythology. And also there's a particular way of being in Kurdish. Did you find that you immediately understood that, or did you have to do a lot of research?
Well, from the very first few pages, after reading the first few pages of the first chapter, I realized that this is something extremely significant, extremely unique. I knew it was going to be a masterpiece. I knew it was going to be a classic. There's just something about it that tells you from the very first few pages. And so I was excited about translating, but I was also very nervous because, one, I've been translating his journalism, and making that transition from journalism to literature is a huge leap. And I hadn't been engaged in a large-scale literature project before, a translation project of literature. So I was anxious about that, but then also because there was just so much in it that I was unfamiliar with. Now, Behrouz and I, we were both from Iran, but Behrouz is Kurdish-Iranian. Now, his first language is Kurdish, but he has been educated in Farsi and obviously has to write in Farsi because me and Munis as well, we're both Farsi speakers and Farsi and engaged with the language in Farsi. There was just so much in it that I realized was different from what I'd known in terms of Persian folklore and history, literature, different literary figures, frames of reference, political traditions and histories. So there's just a whole range of different things that were being alluded to or defined or integrated together that I found I needed to do something extra. I needed to do a little bit more work to really engage in it on the level that it deserved. And one of the things that did help with working with Behrouz was that he's from an extremely marginalized group in Iran. I mean, the Kurds are very badly stigmatized and face a whole range of different kinds of structural oppression. Now, I'm Persian, I'm a Persian-Iranian, but my family's from a religious minority, so we also experienced forms of some structural oppression. And so even though we're from these different marginalized groups, we could understand each other, and we talk about Iranian society and politics and history in very similar ways. On top of that, he's a marginalized group within the Kurdish community because he's from a Shia background, whereas most Sunnis in Iran are Kurdish. Most Kurds in Iran are Sunnis. And on top of that, I'm also in double marginalized. They have experiencing migration and being in Australia and the different kinds of obstacles, barriers that migrants face in Australia. So, and now I'm in Egypt, so it's a whole other level as well. But this kind of experience of being marginalized, being on the borders, being fringe, also this experience of forced migration and also exile, helped me connect with Bedrus, and I could start to understand and appreciate the folkloric element of his work and how storytelling, and a very particular kind of storytelling, a sensitivity to marginalization, to hidden histories, suppressed histories, ignored voices, these sorts of things really became powerful elements, became priorities in terms of how we were trying to get the message across. So I can talk more about the folklore if you like, but folklore, myth, and epic, as well as a particular kind of personal testimony or personal storytelling, were key factors in the in both of our
experiences.
I think it's significant that as I was waiting for this seminar to begin, I was going through my my news feeds, and I saw two articles. One of them was an article by the Financial Times about Bedrus Buchani announcing that he's a visiting professor at Birkbeck University of London. So this is a three-year appointment. You can't obviously go there. You'll be engaging with academics and students through Skype or Zoom. But I thought I'd mention that. And in addition, in the Saturday paper today, there's an article by Shalinda Kanapati, who is a Sri Lankan writer and a prisoner who's just been transported from Manus Island to Port Moresby. And he works closely with Bedrus. So I wanted to mention these two examples of writers, intellectuals, creatives, who have been working for many, many years from Manus Island and are now in Port Moresby, just to sort of reflect the surreal nature of this whole experience. I mean, my experience with Bedrus, my work with Bedrus has been completely surreal. The fact that I am able to cross boundaries at will, I have all of these privileges and have access to all of these different networks and societies. I accept awards on his behalf and a whole range of different things. And all of this happens while Bedrus is in his cell, while he has to, you know, comment through my phone by using WhatsApp or maybe Skype if it works. And Shalinda, also someone who has been struggling for years and years to just try to develop a writing career and be part of the discourse. And he contacted me, actually, telling me I've just published this article, but I'd seen it already through a newsfeed before he contacted me. So there's this real surreal element to all of this whole experience, and that's a reflection of the situation of the people imprisoned by the Australian state, and also the content and the structure of the work that we're doing, and, of course, the mode of production. So why this element of surrealism is important is because the surrealism trope allows for different kinds of cultural elements, particularly the folkloric, the epic, the mythic. And I think a number of things that were important through the translation process was to, one, recognize Bedrus's indigenous Kurdish presence. So unlike me, who my family had been migrating around Iran, and so we're not really sure of where our original lands are, our ancestral lands are. I'm not really sure where my family background originates from, which part of Iran, although I know that, you know, a couple of generations back they settled in Isfahan. But Bedrus is from the mountains in Kurdistan. He grew up there. He has connection with the land, the stories, the traditions, the customs. He's an indigenous person. The Kurdish people in Iran have been there for thousands and thousands of years, and they're indigenous to that particular part of Kurdistan. They weren't involved in the kind of mass migration movements around Iran or the Persianization of the country at a particular point. They've kept their heritage. So this surrealist trope or framework allows for understanding the Kurdish presence. And also interconnects with issues such as self-determination and custodianship, decolonization, and also creation of new knowledges. So one of the reasons why Behrouz was able to write about Manus Island so well and identify the system and the oppression so well was because he saw what's happening there in terms of the prison and the treatment of the Manusian people as a continuation of the kind of colonial violence he experienced in Iran, whether it was from the Persians, the Arabs, the Turks, all from Western imperial expansion, and of course many other groups who were colonizing Kurdistan over the last many centuries. He could see all of this continuing in his experience in the prison in Manus Island. And so a number of things that I could mention that I think may be interesting for in terms of the translation process was that I really need to engage with this particular kind of history, the iconography, not just in terms of Kurdistan, but specific to Behrouz's own region, in terms of his own family history as well. Mm-hmm. So this kind of consultation and collaboration and sharing really gave me the skills to be able to identify these tropes and symbols and frames of reference in his book. So, you know, you have the references to his mother being his first storytelling instructor, or his first experience of storytelling came from his mother, and the kind of myths that his mother and the folklore that his mother would create. There's a particular kind of storytelling tradition that is really significant in his own village in Kurdistan. That was something that was remarkable for me and helped me understand many of the other elements of the book. There are tropes from Kurdish literature and folklore, the use of animals, the use of liminal figures, the use of nature, the incorporation of nature. And the other thing that I think is significant is the incorporation of dream visions. So trying to talk about something that is so horrific, so surreal, and of course so absurd, this whole situation in terms of offshore detention and Australia's wider border politics, one of the only ways you're able to really explain that is through myth and epic and folklore. And dream visions play a really important part in that respect. So I think I can move on to other issues, but they're essentially some of the most important literary techniques and literary foundations for translation and also for the meaning, understanding the meaning of Behrouz's book.
I think that it would be good to go on with that. I think it's quite pertinent. It's interesting too with the title, No Friend But the Mountains. I guess that comes from his original relationship with the mountains in his village.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. Certainly, the mountains are extremely significant for Kurdish people. One, they have a spiritual significance for them. They're seen as sacred sites. Going back into Kurdish history and folklore, the mountains are the places where the Kurds originated. So there are different kinds of stories about the Kurds being born of the mountains.
Yes.
Hello? Oh, sorry.
It's okay, it's, you're back again.
Dropped out on my side for a second.
Yeah.
Okay. If you can see me and hear me, I can't see you and hear you anymore, but I hope it's okay.
We can see you and we can hear you.
Okay. So basically the mountains are a place where the Kurds believe they originate from. There are different stories about that. For instance, there's a story about Solomon's slaves going into the mountains and then the Kurds being the offspring of Solomon's slaves. There are stories about the Kurds actually emerging from the mountains, being born of the mountains. There's a story related to Persian mythology about the figure named Kaveh the blacksmith. And he goes into the mountains to fight against Zahak, who is a kind of like a the representation of evil, a demonic figure. So he conquers him and frees children who were being held in the mountains, and those children being the Kurds. So there are a whole range of different stories, but the significance here is that the mountains are represent an origin story. And there's also a lot of stories, especially the one with Kaveh, when he frees the children, when he defeats the his nemesis in the mountains, he lights fires throughout the mountains in celebration. And this fire is significant, especially in a lot of ancient religious traditions in Iran, particularly the Zoroastrian tradition. But also it's important as a kind of sign of purification. And on top of that, you have this relationship to fire as being a symbol of wisdom as well. It represents knowledge. So the fire plays an important role, and every year during the New Year period, there's a tradition called Charsham Besuri. It's a particular day in the holiday period where people jump over a fire as a kind of ritual, a kind of a ceremony. And that jumping over the fire is a way of reliving or representing or acknowledging the fight between good and evil, the eternal fight between good and evil. Now, what's interesting is that the mountains have an important role in the book. It's in the title. Behrens talks about the mountains. He has many dream visions about the mountains. But the element of fire is interesting here. So Behrens finds kind of solace in the mountains or his memories of the mountains. But because of the scorching sun on Manus Island, because of the way he feels that being in the detention center is like being in a furnace, fire sometimes in some way becomes used in a contradictory way. You know, there's this kind of ambivalent relationship to fire. Whereas in Kurdistan, fire is holy, it's sacred, it's inspirational, represents knowledge. In the detention center, heat and fire, the sun, becomes something that tortures. It becomes an instrument of torture. It becomes weaponized. So there's this interesting, I guess, how would you refer to it? A kind of radical typology related to the symbols and the myths and folklore in Kurdistan. Sometimes they maintain their resonance, their significance. Sometimes there's a typology that takes place. Behrens has to renew them, replace them, make them into anti-tropes almost, or anti-symbols. The other thing with the mountains that I think is interesting is that with the Kurds being constantly under attack by different groups around them, people would have to flee their villages and seek asylum in the mountains. And they would hide in the mountains for protection, but also they'd strategize and organize in the mountains. And they would conduct or initiate their offense from the mountains. So the different guerrilla groups in Kurdistan would launch their attack or try to reclaim their villages after regrouping in the mountains. So the mountains also has this political dimension to it as well, and also a site of sanctuary.
I wanted also to ask you a little bit about the layout of the book, the interspersing of the poems, and which I think are very beautiful and flow on very well. But it's remarkable that you were able to do that, receiving things in such little short grabs. Did you consult, I suppose you did, did you talk about the layout, and how did you decide on using the poetry?
That's a really interesting question, a really interesting feature of the book, and I think one day I really need to write a whole book about the translation process itself. Maybe one book about Behrens writing the book and one book about actually translating the book, because there's just so much to say about it. But if I were to sort of condense it, when I was reading Behrens's writing, and like I mentioned, every chapter was one long text message. There were no paragraph breaks. Farsi literature... any kind of writing in Farsi, but especially literature, has really long sentences. You know, it's an Indo-European language. It has very similar structure to German. It has a similar structure to Romance languages. And, you know, you have the noun, the subject at the beginning. You have the main verb right at the end. And then in between, you have all of these consecutive clauses, many, many different kinds of consecutive clauses. that's representing many different features and elements. And so I'm reading through these long sentences, and they really reflect a kind of rhythm and poetry and melody in the Persian language. But in English, if I were to maintain that same sentence structure, it would be really awkward and cumbersome and completely lose all the significance, all that resonance. So I was thinking, how I can translate these sentences without losing all of that beauty, that poetry in Farsi, and at the same time make it readable in English, make, you know, appeal to an English reading audience. So what I started doing was breaking up these long sentences into shorter sentences. So it was almost like every clause or every two clauses became one sentence on their own. But to do this, to break up these long sentences into smaller sentences, I had to repeat nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs, phrases. I had to use different synonyms, use different techniques like alliteration or personification, different sorts of things, to basically capture the context of that passage, but also to make people understand that these are not just randomly broken up sentences. They're sentences that were originally part of one whole sentence. So once I started doing this through the editing process and discussing it with Bedros, you know, he agreed with what we were doing at the time. And after about the third review, I looked at certain passages and I thought, you know, this sounds like a poem. All this repetition, all of this kind of poetic technique, all of these frames of references, all of this imaginative experimental use of terms, it really sounded like poetry. So what we decided to do at a certain point was we agreed that Farsi prose in some parts needs to become English poetry. So Farsi prose became English verse. And it worked really well. And the product is what you have in the book now, and we're glad we made that decision. It was a form of experimentation, and it worked.
It's very beautiful. I wondered also, when Behrouz started his writing, obviously he was writing with difficulty. I believe his throne was taken and so forth. Did he have to sort of do it in a hidden way? I mean, did he have to...
To understand what happens in the prison, also it's a very complicated history with ever-changing processes and policies and events and situations. So, at one stage, I think it's important we need to write about the different periods in the prison,
yes,
in this whole system. So in the first 6 months of being exiled to Manus, it was an extremely harsh situation. There was a lot of brutality. Detainees were hardly being fed. And Bedros at that time had to work out a way to get a phone into the prison because phones were banned. And the whole prison was in lockdown. No one could leave, no one could go in. And of course, there was this secrecy associated with Operation Sovereign Borders that no journalists could report on it, no one working in there could take out any information or convey any information. So Bedros and some other prisoners and managed to find ways through the kind of underground economy that emerged there. They found a way to get really basic mobile phones into the detention center. And like in all situations, all prisons, people find a way to survive and a way to resist. And getting these phones in, especially through local prison guards, Manusian prison guards, they were able to get phones in, and they had really bad reception. So the reception made it almost impossible to really communicate, but they managed at certain parts of the day to connect with some kind of internet that was in the area. It was the Lombrum Naval Base at that time, so it was really out of the way from the main town. So this phone he had to keep hidden because the guards would conduct early morning raids randomly. So like 4 or 5 in the morning, guards would come in sometimes and check their belongings and confiscate things. So he knew that, one, if he wrote on paper, it would end up being confiscated at a certain point. He would lose it completely, and all his work would have gone to waste. And he also knew that he could send things by WhatsApp, and he knew that once it's in WhatsApp, you can't lose it. Either somebody else has it in their feed, or it's in his own message feed. So WhatsApp was safe in that respect. But he had his phone confiscated twice. His phone was taken by guards during these early morning raids, and he managed to get another one every time. But after 2016, when the Supreme Court in Papua New Guinea ruled that the detention centre is unconstitutional and illegal, Australia couldn't keep the doors of the prison locked, so people could come and go. Of course, they had nowhere to go. They couldn't leave the island, and they had no access to any services. But they couldn't keep them locked up in the prison 24 hours a day. And also, they couldn't stop them from having phones. So at that point, he didn't have a problem in terms of having a phone. But for the first 3.5 years, roughly, yes, that was the case. He was hiding his phone. And there were times, like 2 weeks at a time, when there was no contact from Bedros because he just was paranoid about losing his phone, so he kept it hidden in a mattress. I should mention that he did have his phone stolen once after 2016, so he was outside the camp and he had his phone stolen, but that was the only other time that he lost his phone. After that, he worked out a way to keep his phone. And
Well, it's a miracle, really, that such a beautiful book has emerged, and it's an amazing process all around both Belarus and you as translator and all the other people who helped. A very complex way of translating, which I'm sure you could tell us a lot more about, but it is just about the end of our time. Well, I thought we might throw it open to the audience who probably have questions they would like to ask you, if that's okay?
Of course. I'm sorry, I can't see anyone at the moment, but that's okay. You can see me.
Well, just imagine us, we're all here. Any questions?
Okay.
The original kind of evolved in this same time period, and that his audience was actually English speakers, I guess. And I was thinking that that's such a strange form of translation, where the translation itself is the finished product, I guess, and that he's trying to reach an audience with such political reasons, and I wondered what the original is it going to have an audience in Iran? Will the book be published as well, or is it really an Australian audience specifically with this political agenda that he has as his goal?
That's a great question. So much to say about that. Bedros, when he was writing the first 30% roughly of the book, he was still trying to understand the system. He was still trying to understand what was happening to them and why it was happening, and the different kinds of technologies that were being employed in the prison. And of course, Australia's broader border regime and Australia's history of colonialism. So I'd say the first 30% of the book was written not necessarily with the... I mean, he had hoped that one day this would reach an English-speaking audience, but he was writing for himself and for, I imagine, Farsi readers. So I don't think he was really consciously writing, thinking that this is going to be translated for an English audience. He was just writing as a form of survival, writing as a way just to basically document what's happened here so it won't be forgotten. So I don't think it was in the beginning, I don't think it was really clear for him that he would be writing specifically for an English audience. As time went on, the second, third, and then the last part, more and more, especially in our conversations and talking more about Australia, more about Australia's political system and society and history, he got a better grasp of who he was writing for and what was going to happen in the future with this book. So I guess through these conversations, his style, his trajectory, his techniques might have been honed a little bit more in this direction. The original Farsi, so much changed with the translation. So all of those changes I told you about that Bedros and I did over the phone, through text messaging, through sometimes even voice text, all of those changes were never made to the original text. I incorporated into the translation, but we just had no time, and we were under so much pressure and there was so much stress and so much uncertainty that we just didn't have the time to modify the original document that I had. So if you look at the English version and you look at the Farsi, there's huge differences because a lot of the transformation, a lot of the changes occurred through WhatsApp. But what Bedros is doing now is that he's going back and modifying the original Farsi based on the changes that he made when we were creating the English version. And he has a contract now with the biggest publisher in Iran to publish it. Who knows when that'll be? It could be sometime late next year. And that publisher, unfortunately, because it has to go through the process in the official process in Iran, it will end up being censored. But what we're planning to do is maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 years down the line, we'll publish outside of Iran the uncensored original Farsi version. So this has a huge, this book, the original and the translation has a huge afterlife.
Any more questions or comments? Yes.
Hi, my name is Luciana. I've been following Bedros on Twitter and Facebook for a while. I was wondering though, looking at it from, I'm Italian, looking at it from sort of an outsider point of view, it sounds very much like the witness writing coming out of the extermination camps of the Second World War. I haven't really read anything around the book. Can you tell me if there have been sort of links or likenesses or if this has been likened to it, please?
Yeah, a very interesting question. At the moment in Cairo, I'm teaching a course called Prison Writing. And here I bring works from all different cultures and time periods and different kind of situations into the course. So I'm actually situating Bedros's work in a much larger tradition of prison writing. And certainly people like Jean Amery and Primo Levi and Viktor Frankl, Anne Frank, a whole range of different writers who were in those situations, and also a lot of people writing from prison in Middle East and Africa and Asia as well, and of course Australia and New Zealand. So I'm bringing all of these together to sort of think about the differences and the similarities. Bedros himself drew on inspiration from Kurdish literature and Kurdish history, and some, I guess, Persian as well, general Iranian history and literature, but his understanding of oppression and torture, incarceration, comes from the Kurdish history and literature, and also, of course, the oral history, particularly because he was born during the Iran-Iraq War, and so much of what was happening to people in their villages was like concentration camps. Now, also, there's another really important point. Bedros was reading works from Kurdish and Persian literature, but he was also, while he was writing the book, but he was also reading Franz Kafka. He was reading Samuel Beckett. At a certain point, he was reading Faulkner. He would also read And some other examples as well. But he didn't read, for example, Primo Levi till after the book was finished. And he didn't read some other prison writers until after, from other cultures, until after the book was finished. And he actually thought that that was a good thing. He said that, "I didn't want to be influenced by another person's style. I didn't want to kind of condition my form of writing. I wanted to be completely free to write about what I was experiencing." And the other thing is that a lot of the other forms of prison writing are mainly testimony. You know, there's so much about it that is about the lived experience and about details, about accounting for what happens every day and the experiences between different people and the power structures. But Bedros's book is not that at all. It doesn't fit neatly into that prison writing history because, like I mentioned, there's folklore, there's epic, there's myth, there's... there are elements of fiction in the book. Bedros creates composite characters, and he designs situations that are made up of many different situations at times. He also brings in philosophy and psychoanalysis and some kind of radical interpretations of history as well. So his book, I call it an anti-genre. So in a way, it does... into the prison writing category, but and also the poetry as well. I forgot to mention the poetry as well is really significant. So it does fit into the prison writing tradition, but at the same time, it transcends it as well. There's so much more beyond it.
To me, it actually read a bit like 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You know, it's a kind of a magical realist landscape, and this very long, complex world. You know, a whole world that's envisioned.
That's something we thought about a lot. And I'm sorry, I'll let you finish your question.
No, it wasn't a question really; it was a comment.
I'd really like to respond to this because it's something really interesting happened during the translation process. I was here in Cairo. I moved to Cairo towards the end of 2017, and about half of the translation had been done when I moved to Cairo, and maybe more, maybe about 80% of the translation was done when I came to Cairo, and I was until that time, I really felt that Bedros's style was magical realist, and I'd often think about what I was translating. Is magical realist. But then I had a really interesting conversation with one of my colleagues who was an expert in magical realism here in Cairo. And she was telling me that when we were talking about, and I was telling her about the book, she said, "No, Omid, that's not magical realism." And here I went again and I did more research and into the kind of style, and I realized she was completely right. Magical realism assumes that the world is already fantastic. It's already magical. The kind of fantasy features of the world are already there. They're part of a reality. Whereas in Bedros's book, the mind plays a massive role in the kind of creation, in the design, in the modification or the manipulation of the real world to make it into this fantasy, to make these kinds of unreal elements or magical elements emerge from the physical world, so and also from the emotional and spiritual world as well. So this particular feature, this distinction between magical realism and what Bedros is doing, I found is more akin to surrealist works. So Bedros' work is actually more surrealist because it has a fragmented, disrupted, shattered, disjointed quality about it. The subconscious has this kind of like really important central role. It's the subconscious that's making these things happen. The situations and the violence is so absurd, especially coming from a country like Australia that has this reputation internationally as a country that respects and upholds the rule of law and human rights. So, you know, there's this ridiculous quality about it, this absurd, ironic nature about it. Bedros also brings in humor into his work as well. So there's all of these different things about it that make it surrealist rather than magical realist. And we added another element to that because there's so much psychological horror and horror realism that he uses in his work. We thought we'd call the genre, not the genre, but the style or the schema of the book, the attitude of the book, horrific surrealism. And that's a coin. That's a term that we coined specifically for Behrouz's book. And we found really interestingly, again, doing more research into Kurdish history and literature and art, that there's so much modern Kurdish creative work that uses horror and surrealism at the same time. So it fits very well into that modern Kurdish tradition.
Any other questions? Anyone else? Anything to say?
I think we're all in awe of what you've done. That we can't say very much more.
This is just the tip of the iceberg. There's just so much still to talk about. Maybe one day I'll write a book about it.
I think you'll have to. I'm just wondering if you could give us a few more minutes. We're going to have a sort of little winding up session, and I would ask Stephanie and Caroline to come out, perhaps to sit up here, and Meg and any of the committee, and just to try and sum up the day. We started with Indigenous writing, or indigenous language and the preserving of it and collecting of it, and then the translating and adapting and preservation of it. But in a way we've gone in a circle, because when I think of the Kurdish indigenous effect upon the work of Behrouz, it's very much linked to, and for other reasons also, to the Australian indigenous story. So and of course, in between that, we had Stephanie Smee, who is a wonderful translator from French into English and has worked on children's stories, Jules Verne and so on, folkloric. So they're all here now, and I'm just wondering if any of them have anything they'd like to say to you, just as a sort of summing up the afternoon. Thank you, Stephanie.
It's Stephanie speaking here. First of all, congratulations. I had the great pleasure of witnessing you accept a prize of the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. And I believe you had Behrouz on the phone speaking. And I think it was quite honestly one of the most moving moments I've witnessed. And I think it's truly the most extraordinarily important work that I've sort of even heard about in my, you know, work with literature and so on. So congratulations.
Thanks.
And I think everybody in the room would agree with that. One of the things that I have found so fascinating reading about your work and listening to you speak about it is the difference that I have experienced from the actual translation process is this sort of glorious collaboration that you have had with Behrouz and also with your other colleagues, who I think you speak about in your translator's comments at the start of the work. And I would love it if just you could share just a little bit more, if you have time, about that collaborative process, because I think translators and literary translators are often lone wolves. You know, we work in a very solitary way, and we like to pick the brains of people, you know, when we get access to them, but it's not always an easy process, and it seems to have been such an integral part of how you have worked, both with Behrouz and your other colleagues. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, if that's possible.
Certainly. Thank you very much for your reflections and for your encouraging words. Because I'd only been translating journalism for Behrouz and some speeches that he was preparing before getting involved in the book, and before meeting Behrouz, I had never done any serious translation. I mean, maybe like a paragraph or a few lines here and there, but I wasn't trained in translation. I had no experience in translation. I'd been interpreting for my parents pretty much most of my life, I never really thought of that as being like a skill set that I was developing, but I think why the translation became so, I guess, natural to me after a particular point was because I had all of these years of thinking in two languages, you know, just interpreting on the spot, and also hearing stories constantly about displacement and exile, about family members all over the world, people I'd never met, but, you know, hearing about them through my parents and through other people. You know, these kinds of things were, in a way, training me for the translation of Bedros's book. So when I moved from journalism into the book, I was really anxious and I was really wondering whether I could do it or not. I thought, you know, have I bitten off more than I can chew? But at the same time, I knew how remarkably important this book would be, and I didn't want to lose this opportunity, and I knew I could really do something special with it if I just had the right kind of support network. So I knew Munis at the time, and so I asked her, you know, would it be okay if we met every couple of weeks to discuss what I'm translating? So what I would do is I would read the English, and she would follow the original Farsi, and she would stop me at certain points and say, you know, let's reconsider this, or what do you think about this, and that sort of thing. And then Sajjad Kabgani is a friend of mine. He's in Iran now, but he was studying in Sydney when I was translating the book, and he did the same thing as well. So sometimes I would meet with Muna, sometimes I would meet with Sajjad. And so those seminars, sometimes they take a few hours, sometimes they take half a day, but they actually became like philosophical kind of workshops. Sometimes we'd spend an hour talking about one word. Sometimes we'd go on a tangent, and one passage from Bedros's book would actually spawn a whole conversation about something we thought was unrelated, but then we realized at the end of the conversation that it helps inform our reading of the text. So there was this really unconventional approach to translation. Every now and then we'd contact Bedros and ask him a question while we were translating. And then when I would go back home, I would call Bedros or message Bedros and ask him, you know, this is what I'm thinking of doing with this section. What do you think? So, in fact, Bedros also became part of the translation team. This translation is partly Bedros's translation as well, even though he's the writer in the original language. So it's hard to categorize. But one thing I think is important is that because I didn't have that background in translation studies and because I wasn't a professional translator, it just gave me this enormous amount of freedom. And Bedros talks about his writing as exhibiting that kind of freedom as well. Because he hadn't read much prison literature and he hadn't really kind of done creative writing as a kind of formal practice, you know, he was basically educated in political science and political geography. So he had this kind of enormous freedom in writing the book, and I had this enormous freedom in translating the book. Like, I was completely uninhibited. I didn't know what I was doing, and I was always insecure about whether I was doing it right. I thought, at a certain point, I thought, whatever, I'll just do anything. I'll just experiment with anything that comes to mind. And, you know, through the consultation and the collaboration, we came to an agreement on a lot of things, and it worked. And it's interesting, outside of this small circle of friends and colleagues, we didn't get any feedback for the book. No one gave us any feedback. So the writing and the translation of the book outside of this small group was, there wasn't really this culture of, external editors coming in. The only editorial work from outside came in after the whole translation was finished, and that was my interaction with the editor at Picador. But actually getting feedback while the book was written, Bedros was just talking to his colleagues in Iran, me, and then there was the translation consultants.
They focused on the contents more than the translation.
Thank you. That's fascinating.
Thank you. That's really, well, I think we'd say miraculous. Me?
Oh,
questions from the audience.
Sorry, it's Luchan again. When I was reading, I was wondering, how did he keep his sanity? And in a way, I'm wondering, how did he keep yours?
it must not have been easy to be talking to someone whose experience you were actually not only reading, but you were reading while he was writing. It wasn't done. It wasn't passed. I've translated some trauma literature, so I know how hard it can be, but I'm pretty sure it must have been particularly hard for you, knowing that he was still in that situation, and you know, going to receive a prize for a book for a man who is still in that situation must be particularly taxing. So I'm just wondering how did you negotiate?
Yeah. It's the first time someone's asked me this question, so I need to think a little bit about that. I was not only translating for Bedros, I was also, and I still am, working on his release and, you know, supporting him in terms of trying to gain networks, especially in academic communities. We're working on in different ways on his applications for different places. When I first met Bedros and first started engaging with him, I didn't even have the plan or didn't even imagine that I would translate for him. He asked me to translate for him, you know, after about a few weeks after I met him. And we were talking about dismantling the system, challenging the system, exposing what's happening, and translation just kind of came up in conversation, and then it became the main thing. Bedros was also writing so much of the book while those incidents were taking place. So much of what you're reading, Bedros was writing either at the time it was happening or immediately after. So, for instance, when he writes about starvation in the book, he was starving. He was in his bed. He missed out on like two meals in a row, and he was hungry, and he wrote those parts of the book while he was experiencing that. While being humiliated and being bullied and tortured through making him wait in line for 2-3 hours, he was writing that chapter about queuing as torture while he was in the queue. So, you know, there's so much of that, and this came out in the conversations we had. So I was really kind of absorbing all of this, and you know, there were moments where I really had to pause and, you know, to translate. Sometimes you have to kind of enter that world. Most times you have to enter that world, and there were times when there were passages in the book about self-harm, about even just viciousness between refugees, because the system creates hatred between refugees as well. And so there were all these really uncomfortable, really stressful and stressful things that, you know, you had to sort of immerse yourself in. I have to think more about this question, because I haven't really been asked it before, and there's just so much to say about it. But I will say that there's also something about the book that I think we have to accept that we'll never understand, and even me as a translator. I think as, you know, years go by after the book, I'll understand more and more about the book. And, you know, there's probably a lot of this connects with the surrealist element. There's a lot of subconscious feelings and thoughts that have been part of this process, and I'll probably start to realize this much more, years ahead. So,
thank you very much. I think we might leave it there. You've got one more? Did someone want? No. We've taken up a lot of your time, and you've been most generous and very open and honest. Thank you very much for doing that.
My pleasure. Thank you for organising this.
It's a miracle of a book, which I recommend that you all read and think about. And I'm just going to say thank you to everybody. Thank you very much, Stephanie, for your contribution, and Caroline. The Harley and Ruth had to go early, so we thank them in absentia. But it's been a really stimulating, fascinating,
and saddening afternoon. And we thank you very much, Ermin, for being part of it.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you, and I hope to meet all of you.
Can I just add a big thank you to Elaine Lewis? Can we put our hands together for Elaine? Without her, this afternoon would never happen. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming. And if the committee members wouldn't mind staying, and we'll put the chairs back, etc. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.